This is Audible.
Broadside Books and Harper Audio present The Authoritarian Moment, How the Left Weaponized America's Institutions Against Dissent by Ben Shapiro. This is the author. A note before we begin. Don't forget to download the accompanying enhancement PDF from your audiobook provider or go directly to www.harpercollins.com/audio/authoritarian moment. The enhancement contains the book's endnotes. To my children, who deserve to grow up in a country that values the freedoms promised by the Declaration of Independence and guaranteed by our Constitution. Introduction. According to the institutional powers that be, America is under authoritarian threat. That authoritarian threat to America, according to the Democratic Party, establishment media, social media tech bros, Hollywood glitterati, corporate bosses, and university professors, is clear, and it comes directly from the political right. And that authoritarian threat, according to those who control vast swaths of American life, manifested itself most prominently on January 6th, 2021. On that day, hundreds, if not thousands, of rioters broke away from a far larger group of pro-Trump peaceful protesters and stormed the United States Capitol, many seeking to do violent harm to members of Congress and the Vice President of the United States. Their goal, to overturn the legally constituted results of the 2020 election. The images from January 6th were indeed dramatic, and the rioters of January 6th did indeed engage in acts of criminal evil. Pictures of barbarians dressed in buffalo horns and idiots carrying Trump flags and military gear-clad fools carrying zip cuffs made the front pages globally. Sitting congresspeople and the Vice President of the United States were rushed to safety, shielding themselves from the droogs beyond. All Americans of goodwill on all political sides decried the January 6th riots. Vice President Pence personally oversaw the counting of the electoral votes. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, condemned the rioters as vile cretins, then moved forward to the certification of the election. But according to the left, the January 6th riots weren't merely an act of universally condemned criminality. They were the culmination of right-wing authoritarianism. Jonathan Chait of New York Magazine wrote, "We entrusted a sociopathic, instinctive authoritarian with the most powerful office in the world. What did we think would happen?" Paul Krugman of the New York Times suggested, "One of our major political parties has become willing to tolerate and, indeed, feed right-wing political paranoia. The GOP has reached the culmination of its long journey away from democracy, and it's hard to see how it can ever be redeemed." Greg Sargent of the Washington Post explained, "Trump's GOP has an ugly authoritarian core." Lisa McGurr wrote in the New York Times, "Republicans will certainly seek to pivot from the riot, but the nativism, extreme polarization, truth bashing, white nationalism, and anti-democratic policies that we tend to identify with President Trump are likely to remain a hallmark of the Republican playbook into the future." "If you voted for Trump," said Don Lemon of CNN, "you voted for the person who the Klan supported. You voted for the person who Nazis support. You voted for the person the alt-right supports. That's the crowd that you are in. You voted for the person who incited a crowd to go into the Capitol and potentially take the lives of lawmakers." Score settling would be necessary. Charles Blow of the New York Times asked, "What do we do now as a society and as a body politic? Do we simply turn the page and hope for a better day, let bygones be bygones? Or do we seek some form of justice to hold people accountable for taking this country to the brink?" Joy Reid of MSNBC called for de-bathification, a la the post-Iraq War purge of Saddam Hussein's military. Indeed, the American left argued, the greatest threat to America's future came from right-wing authoritarianism, which, naturally, the left conflated with white supremacy and conservative philosophy. To fail in the quest of ridding America of this threat would spell the end of the republic. Authoritarianism had to be stopped. But what if the most dangerous authoritarian threat to America wasn't the several hundred evil conspiracists, fools, and criminals who breached the Capitol? What if the most dangerous authoritarian threat to the country wasn't a properly despised group of agitators making asses of themselves by charging into the Hall of Democracy, variously dressed in military gear, animal skins, and buffalo horns? What if the primary threat to American liberty lies elsewhere? What if, in fact, the most pressing authoritarian threat to the country lies precisely with the institutional powers that be? In the well-respected centers of journalism, in the gleaming towers of academia, in the glossy offices of the Hollywood glitterati, in the cubicles of Silicon Valley, and the boardrooms of our corporate behemoths. What if the danger of authoritarianism, in reality, lies with those who are most powerful, with a ruling class that despises the values of half the country and with the institutions they wield? What if the creeping authoritarianism of those who wield power has been slowly growing, unchecked, for years? What if authoritarianism has many strains, and the most virulent strain isn't the paranoia and fear that sometimes manifests on the right, but the self-assured, unearned moral virtue of the left? The authoritarian instinct. Something there is in man that loves a dictator. In the book of Samuel, the people of Israel, threatened from without by warring tribes and within by dissension, seek to end the age of judges. They want a king. They've been warned repeatedly about the disastrous consequences of such a choice. God tells Samuel that the people have rejected me. Samuel excoriates the people, telling them that a king will take your sons and take your daughters and take your fields and your vineyards and take the tenth of your flocks. That in the end, you shall be his servants, and you shall cry out in that day because of the king you chose, and the Lord will not answer you in that day. And the people answer, no, there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Human nature doesn't change. This is the unfortunate truth of human history. Because man is a threat to man, human beings seek safety and satisfaction in authority. Because man is a threat to man, human beings seek the possibility of a remolding of man, a remolding to be achieved through the exercise of power. Human beings, all too often, trust not in the moral authority of a God above, looking down benevolently on humanity, providing ethical guidelines for building fulfilling lives in rich communities. Instead, they look to the earthly authority of a king, a leader, an institution. It took just a few weeks from the splitting of the Red Sea for the Jews to embrace the golden calf. Human beings are ripe for authoritarianism. For most of human history, authoritarianism manifested in centralized government systems, monarchies, oligarchies, aristocracies. The widespread democracy of the post-World War II period is extraordinary and extraordinarily fragile. Human beings may be granted freedom, but freedom has a short shelf life. Democracy is threatened chiefly by ochlocracy, the rule of the mob. Mob rule transforms freedom into authoritarianism in two ways. Through reactionary brutality, in which citizens seek protection from the winds of change without and within, a form of brutality largely associated with the political right, and utopian brutality, in which citizens seek to escape present challenges through the transformation of mankind itself, a form of brutality largely associated with the political left. Often, the two forms of brutality feed on each other, creating a downward spiral into tyranny. This is precisely what happened in Weimar Germany, where the utopian brutality of German communists came into conflict with the reactionary brutality of German Nazis. The winning side implemented the most vicious tyranny in the history of mankind. The losing side was an offshoot of one of the most vicious tyrannies in the history of mankind. Neither side sought the preservation of a democratic, rights-based system. The founding fathers of the United States saw in mob rule the greatest danger to their nascent system, and they put in place governmental checks and balances in order to protect individual rights from the frenzied whims of the riotous mass. The Constitution was designed to check ambition against ambition, passion against passion. James Madison famously abhorred faction, by which he meant a number of citizens, whether amounting to a majority or a minority of the whole, who are united and actuated by some common impulse of passion or of interest, adverse to the rights of other citizens or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. He posited two possible ways of preventing faction. One, by destroying the liberty, which is essential to its existence. The other, by giving to every citizen the same opinions, the same passions, and the same interests. Both ways would end in authoritarianism. The solution, he suggested, lay in checks and balances, in creating such a diffusion of interests that combination would become nearly impossible. For a while, it worked. It worked for two reasons. First, the checks and balances built by the founders were wondrous in their durability. The hopes of would-be authoritarians were routinely stymied by the balances of federalism, of separation of powers. Those checks and balances remain durable today. The constitutional system's series of speed bumps certainly blunts momentum. Despite the best attempts of members of both parties to completely override the constitutional order, excesses are often mitigated, at least in small part. Second, and more important, the American people broadly rejected the impulses of the mob. They rejected both the utopianism of left-wing authoritarianism and the reactionary nature of right-wing authoritarianism. Core American freedoms, freedoms of speech and of the press, freedoms of religion and association, were widely perceived to be beyond debate. If oppression deeply marred American history, and of course it did so against a backdrop of American liberty, more and more broadly applied to more and more Americans. The Founding Fathers were united in their support for a culture of freedom, particularly freedom of thought and speech. The authoritarian mindset. But beneath the surface, the authoritarian mindset always looms. In 1950, Frankfurt School theorist Theodore Adorno, along with University of California, Berkeley researchers Elsa Frankel Brunswick, Daniel Levinson, and Nevitt Sanford, authored a book titled The Authoritarian Personality. The book, an attempt to explore the origins of antisemitism, posited that people could be classified via the use of a so-called F scale. F meaning pre-fascist personality. Adorno et al. Posited that such personalities were churned out by the American system. The authors suggested, the modification of the potentially fascist structure cannot be achieved by psychological means alone. The task is comparable to that of eliminating neuroses, or delinquency, or nationalism from the world. These are the products of the total organization of society and are to be changed only as that society is changed. Because Adorno was a leftist and a Freudian, the analysis was deeply flawed. The very possibility of a left-wing authoritarianism was ignored by Adorno. Still, right-wing authoritarianism is quite real. Following in Adorno's footsteps, Harvard social scientist Robert Altmaier utilized a right-wing authoritarianism, RWA scale, attempting to detect three character traits. Authoritarian submission, or willingness to submit to established and legitimate authorities. Authoritarian aggression, or aggressiveness approved by the authorities against a particular outgroup. Conventionalism, defined by adherence to approved social conventions. Altmaier found that right-wing authoritarianism was surprisingly common. Surprisingly, Altmaier found that left-wingers were not at all susceptible to authoritarianism. Altmaier concluded that left-wing authoritarianism was like the Loch Ness Monster, an occasional shadow, but no monster. Perhaps that had something to do with the fact that the left-wing authoritarianism, or LWA, scale loaded the questions. In fact, when University of Montana social psychologist Lucian Conway simply rewrote Altmaier's exact questions, replacing only the right-wing premises with left-wing premises, he found that the highest score for authoritarianism was for liberals on LWA. Conway explained, "Our data suggests that average Americans on the political left are just as likely to be dogmatic authoritarians as those on the political right. And those left-wing authoritarians can be just as prejudiced, dogmatic, and extremist as right-wing authoritarians. The content of the dogma is merely different. As sociologist Thomas Costello of Emory University et al. Writes, left-wing authoritarianism is characterized by three traits that look quite similar to those of right-wing authoritarianism. Revolutionary aggression, designed to forcefully overthrow the established hierarchy and punish those in power. Top-down censorship, directed at wielding group authority as a means of regulating characteristically right-wing beliefs and behaviors. Anti-conventionalism, reflecting a moral absolutism concerning progressive values and concomitant dismissal of conservatives as inherently immoral. An intolerant desire for coercively imposing left-wing beliefs and values on others and a need for social and ideological homogeneity in one's environment. In reality, there are authoritarians on all sides. Even Adorno came to take this view. During the student protests of the 1960s, Adorno, who taught at the Free University of Berlin, was confronted by student radicals. He wrote a plaintive letter to fellow Frankfurt School theorist Herbert Marcuse, complaining about the left-wing authoritarianism he saw in the student protesters who occupied his room and refused to leave. "We had to call the police, who then arrested all those they found in the room. They treated the students far more leniently than the students treated me." Adorno wrote that the students had displayed something of that thoughtless violence that once belonged to fascism. Marcuse, a strident left-wing authoritarian himself, he infamously proposed that repressive tolerance required that dissenting right-wing views be censored, then chided Adorno, stating that our cause is better taken up by the rebellious students than by the police, and argued that violence by the left was merely fresh air. Authoritarians rarely recognize their own authoritarianism. To them, authoritarianism looks like simple virtue. The authoritarian question. So, if there are authoritarians on the right and on the left, and if the two feed on each other, driving America ever deeper into a moral morass, where does the true risk lie? To answer that question requires us to evaluate two more questions. First, which form of authoritarianism is more common in the halls of power? Second, which form of authoritarianism is more likely to be checked? Let's revisit January 6th and its aftermath with these questions in mind. There's little doubt that the rioters of January 6th were right-wing authoritarians. They invaded the Capitol building in order to stop the workings of democracy, overthrow the constitutional process, and harm those seeking to do their legal duty. They participated in authoritarian submission. They believed they were doing the work of President Donald Trump against a corrupt and effete establishment. They participated in authoritarian aggression. They believed they were empowered to do harm in order to defend Trump and take on the legislative branch. And they were engaged in conventionalism. They felt they were defending established values, the flag, the vote, democracy itself, against a revolution from within. On January 6th, these right-wing authoritarians invaded the Capitol. And, contrary to popular opinion, the system held. As it turns out, authoritarianism on the right was checked, in large measure, by members of the right. It was Vice President Mike Pence who sent a letter to President Trump explaining he would do his duty to see to it that we open the certificates of the electors of the several states, we hear objections raised by senators and representatives, and we count the votes of the Electoral College for president and vice president in a manner consistent with our Constitution, laws, and history. So help me God. It was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, who congratulated Joe Biden on his victory immediately after the Electoral College vote. It was Republicans in the Senate who abandoned their electoral challenges immediately upon the reconvening of the electoral counting after the Capitol building was cleared out. It was Republican governors and secretaries of state who certified their state votes. The institutions held. Many in the media termed January 6th a coup, but it was never a coup in any proper sense. A coup requires institutional support. Certainly the rioters had no institutional support. In fact, Trump himself never explicitly called for the Capitol riot, stated in his speech that morning that he wanted the protest to be peaceful, tweeted that he wanted everyone to go home in the midst of the riot, the vast majority of his supporters at the rally already had, and eventually, far too late, of course, put out a statement in which he acknowledged his defeat and told his supporters to remain peaceful. Trump might have authoritarian tendencies, but he did not wield authoritarian power. And beyond Trump himself, not a single major institution in American society supported the Capitol riots. Few even supported the president's efforts to challenge the election beyond the Electoral College vote. As a matter of fact, whatever personal authoritarian tendencies Trump may have had were checked throughout his administration. Trump had certainly engaged in authoritarian rhetoric. He utilized violent language, he suggested weaponization of the legal system, he called for breaches of the Constitution, and nothing happened. His much maligned attorneys general refused to violate the law. He didn't fire Special Investigator Robert Mueller. His anger at the press translated mostly into increased ratings for his enemies. CNN's Jim Acosta, who spent every waking minute proclaiming that he was endangered by Trump's overheated talk, became a household name thanks to his grandstanding. At no point did Acosta fear arrest or even deplatforming. The shock of January 6th was that the guardrails collapsed for a brief moment in time after holding for years on end. And then the guardrails were re-erected, including by some of Trump's erstwhile allies. Now let's turn to the other side of the aisle. In the aftermath of January 6th, America's institutional powers swung into action on behalf of authoritarian measures. Establishment media broadly promoted the idea of deplatforming mainstream conservatives and conservative outlets. CNN reported that the Capitol riot had reignited a debate over America's long-held defense of extremist speech. Naturally, the media quoted experts like Wendy Seltzer, affiliate at Harvard's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society, to the effect that free speech primarily benefited those who are white. Nicole Hannah-Jones, the serial social media prevaricator and Pulitzer Prize-winning purveyor of historical fiction about the inherent evils of America, quickly asked for a reckoning in the media. Max Boot suggested in the pages of the Washington Post that Fox News be removed from Comcast or that the Federal Communications Commission be empowered to censor cable networks, stating, "Biden needs to reinvigorate the FCC, or else the terrorism we saw on January 6th may be only the beginning rather than the end of the plot against America." This wasn't just talk. Nearly every social media company in America promptly removed President Trump's accounts, even while acknowledging that they could not justify that removal on the basis of their stated policies. Major corporations announced they would cut funding to any Republican who had challenged electoral votes, despite never having done so to Democrats. Senator Josh Hawley, Republican of Missouri, who had supported challenging electors, without serious legal basis, it should be noted, had his publication contract pulled by Simon & Schuster. Harvard Kennedy School of Government dropped Representative Elise Stefanik, Republican of New York, from its senior advisory committee for making public assertions about vote fraud in November's presidential election that have no basis in evidence. GoDaddy.com kicked AR15.com, the biggest gun forum in the world, offline. The most dramatic and immediate reaction to the Capitol riot was the institutional move against Parler. Parler had been launched in August 2018 as an alternative to Twitter. Conservatives had been complaining about Twitter's opacity and discrimination against conservatives relative to leftists. Parler was the supposed free market solution. Then, in the aftermath of the riot, Apple's App Store removed Parler, as did the Google Play Store. The excuse: supposedly, Parler users had coordinated with regard to the January 6th protests, and Parler had allowed inflammatory and threatening material to remain up. The final blow came when Amazon Web Services, a company that merely provides cloud-based web infrastructure for companies, canceled Parler altogether, taking it offline. AWS, Parler CEO John Matzie wrote, "We'll be banning Parler until we give up free speech, institute broad and invasive policies like Twitter and Facebook, and we become a surveillance platform by pursuing guilt of those who use Parler before innocence." As it turned out, Facebook and Twitter had been used by Capitol protesters to coordinate as well. Neither company lost its cloud infrastructure. But leftist members of the media didn't react to that hypocrisy by calling for Parler's restoration. They reacted to it by calling for further censorship against Facebook and Twitter. Joe Scarborough of MSNBC, who throughout the 2016 race spent inordinate time pumping up Trump, ranted, "Those riots would not have happened but for Twitter, but for Facebook. Facebook's algorithms were set up to cause this sort of radicalism to explode. Facebook and Twitter set up their business models in a way that would lead to the insurrection." Other tech journalists mirrored that sentiment, a sentiment they had been pumping for years, hoping to shut down social media companies that distribute alternative sources of media. Meanwhile, governmental actors talked of revenge and of using the Capitol riots to achieve long-sought political goals. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, stated that Congress should put together a media literacy commission in order to figure out how we rein in our media environment. Representative Cori Bush, Democrat of Missouri, called for every single member of Congress who incited this domestic terror attack to be removed from Congress. Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, averred at NBCNews.com that the only way to prevent another Capitol riot was addition of Washington, D.C. as a state, a renewed Voting Rights Act, likely unconstitutional, and universal mail-in voting. As Joe Biden entered office on January 20th, Representative James Clyburn, Democrat of South Carolina, who had compared Donald Trump to Hitler and Republicans to Nazis, said that Biden should simply act unilaterally via executive action to implement his agenda if Congress balked. "If they're going to throw up roadblocks, go on without them. Use your executive authority if they refuse to cooperate. You can do big things and you can do great things. You can do things that are lasting." It is worth noting that there is no clause of the Constitution whereby the president can simply implement his favored policies without congressional approval. To sum up, on January 6th, a group of radical extremist Trump supporters, right-wing authoritarians, stormed the U.S. Capitol, where they were quickly put down. The institutions survived. The insurrectionists were roundly derided, disowned, and prosecuted. Immediately thereafter, left-wing authoritarians took full advantage of the situation to press forward revolutionary aggression, top-down censorship, and anti-conventionalism, targeting not just the rioters, but conservatives and individual rights more broadly. This perspective was mirrored across nearly every powerful institution in American society. So, let us repeat the question. If there is a serious threat to free speech, does it come chiefly from the right-wing authoritarians? Or does it come from the left-wing authoritarians in media, big tech, and government? If there is a threat to democratic institutions, does it come chiefly from right-wing authoritarians? Or does it come from left-wing authoritarians in government who broadly disdain the Constitution and believe in the implementation of their worldview from the top down? If there is a threat to our most basic liberties, whom should we most fear? The dumbasses in clown suits invading the Capitol on January 6th? Donald Trump? A man who talked like an authoritarian but did not actually govern as one? Or the monolithic leftists who dominate the top echelons of nearly every powerful institution in American society and who frequently use their power to silence their opposition? Life under left-wing social authoritarianism. Deep down, Americans know the answer to this question. More than 6 in 10 Americans say they fear saying what they think, including a majority of liberals, 64% of moderates, and fully 77% of conservatives. Only self-described strong liberals feel confident in saying what they believe these days. To be a left-wing authoritarian is to feel the certainty of anti-conventionalism, the passion for top-down censorship, the thrill of revolutionary aggression. Tomorrow belongs to them. For the rest of us, a society run by left-wing authoritarians is extraordinarily burdensome. It is to be surrounded by institutional hatred. If you are a conservative or merely non-leftist in America, the hatred is palpable. They hate you in academia. They hate you in the media. They hate you on the sports field, in the movies, on Facebook and Twitter. Your boss hates you. Your colleagues hate you, or at least have been told they should. They hate you because you think the wrong way. Perhaps the problem is that you attend church regularly. Perhaps it's that you want to run your business and be left alone. Perhaps it's that you want to raise your children with traditional social values. It could be that you believe that men and women exist, or that the police are generally not racist, or that children deserve a mother and a father, or that hard work pays off, or that the American flag stands for freedom rather than oppression, or that unborn children should not be killed, or that people should be judged based on the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. Maybe the problem is that you won't post a black square on your Facebook page to symbolize your support for the Black Lives Matter movement. Maybe the problem is that you won't kneel for the national anthem or cheer for those who kneel. Maybe it's that you haven't put your preferred pronouns in your Twitter profile or hashtagged with the latest pride symbol for the latest cause or used the proper emoji in your text messages. Or maybe it's just that you have friends or family members or even acquaintances who have violated any of the thicket of cultural regulations placed upon us by our supposed moral betters. Guilt by association is just as damning as guilt through action or inaction. The reasons they hate you are legion. They change day to day. There's no rhyme or reason or consistency to them. One day you might be a ballyhooed champion of justice for standing up for gay rights or feminist ideals. The next day, you might be told that you've been banished to the cornfield for your refusal to acknowledge that a man calling himself a woman is not, in fact, a woman. Martina Navratilova or J.K. Rowling. One day, you might find yourself a hero of the intelligentsia for your cynicism about religion. The next, you might find yourself a villain for the great sin of suggesting that cancel culture breeds radicalization. Sam Harris or Steven Pinker. One day, you might be a well-respected opinion maker, considered de rigueur reading for your complex take on economics and sociology. The next, you might be considered a privileged white male worthy of excommunication, David Shore or Matthew Iglesias. This is not a question of Democrat or Republican. Not one figure I just mentioned would identify as a Republican, let alone a conservative. There is only one thing in the end that unites the disparate figures deemed worthy of the gulag in our ongoing culture war. Refusal. Like Herman Melville's Bartleby, it is simple refusal that demands compulsion. The standards matter less than the simple message. You will comply and you will like it. The consequences for those who do not are quite real. As a prominent conservative, I always warn those who aren't prepared for social, cultural, and familial blowback not to associate with me publicly. There are consequences for treating conservatives as human. That's why every birthday I'm amused but unsurprised to receive a bevy of kind wishes from liberals via text message and none publicly in places like Twitter, where the mere recognition that a conservative was born of woman is enough to earn unending scorn. Such situations are far from hypothetical. In June 2018, prominent Hollywood actor and producer Mark Duplass approached me about getting together. He was producing a film dealing with gun rights and wanted to speak with someone on the right to get a more accurate point of view. I thought that was shockingly decent of him, given Hollywood's permanent and thoroughgoing determination to caricature conservative positions. I told him so and suggested he come by the office for a discussion. We ended up spending about an hour and a half together. As he left, I gave him the usual warning. Don't mention that we've met publicly unless you're prepared for the fallout. He didn't listen. In July, a couple of weeks later, he tweeted this shocking message. Fellow liberals, if you are interested at all in crossing the aisle, you should consider following Ben Shapiro. I don't agree with him on much, but he's a genuine person who once helped me for no other reason than to be nice. He doesn't bend the truth. His intentions are good. The world fell in on poor Mark. After trending on Twitter publicly and surely receiving a boatload of nasty notes privately, Mark quickly deleted his tweet and then replaced it with a Maoist struggle session of hot-button social justice warrior thought vomit. So, that tweet was a disaster on many levels. I want to be clear, I in no way endorse hatred, racism, homophobia, xenophobia, or any such form of intolerance. My goal has always been to spread unity, understanding, and kindness. But I am going to make mistakes along the way. Sometimes I move too quickly when I get excited or fail to do enough research or I don't communicate myself clearly. I'm really sorry. I now understand that I need to be more diligent and careful. I'm working on that. But I do believe deeply in bipartisan understanding, and I will continue to do my best to promote peace and decency in this world right now. That said, I hear you. And I want to say thank you to those who reached out with constructive criticism. I have genuinely learned so much and wish everyone all the best. Well, almost everyone. Honestly, I felt rather sorry for him. Duplass has to work in this town, and Hollywood is a one-party ideological dictatorship. That said, I did warn him, and cowardice is indeed a form of sin. Naturally, Duplass's craven apology to the world for having acknowledged that a conservative is indeed human brought cheers from the usual suspects. Fox's Zach Beauchamp headlined, "Duplass was right to take back his praise." Order had been restored. The binary moral universe ruled by the woke priestly caste had been maintained. And it will be maintained. Because Duplass isn't alone. This sort of stuff happens all the time. Just about a year after the Duplass incident, I attended a rather tony political summit, perhaps the only real ritzy cocktail party I've ever gone to. One of the other attendees happened to be one of the more prominent left-wing podcasters in the country. After a few pleasantries, I suggested that perhaps we ought to do an election year crossover podcast. The numbers, I said, would be extraordinary, and I know my audience would love it. We're always having on guests who disagree. I'm sure your audience would be cool with it, the podcaster answered, but mine would murder me. He wasn't wrong, which is why when I meet prominent people from conservative sports stars to libertarian tech magnates, from right-wing Hollywood creators to good-hearted liberals in the media world, I do so quietly. I'm not in the business of taking billions of dollars off the market capitalization of major corporations or getting studio heads fired simply by confirming with whom I lunch. Those who violate ideological quarantine risk being treated as lepers in this environment. Now, I'm lucky. I speak my views for a living. But tens and tens of millions of people aren't so lucky. For them, the consequences of speaking non-leftist views publicly in our absolutist time are grave. The authoritarian left seeks to quell dissent, and they use every means at their disposal to do so. Every day, I receive dozens of letters and calls from people asking how to navigate the minefield of American life. It's easily the most common question I receive. My boss is forcing me into diversity training in which I'm told that all white Americans are inherently racist. Should I speak up about it? I'm afraid I'll be fired. My professor says that anyone who refuses to use preferred pronouns is a bigot. What should I write on my final? I'm afraid he'll grade me down. My sister knows I voted for Republicans. Now she says she doesn't want to talk to me. What do I do? The consequences of woke cultural authoritarianism are real, and they are devastating. They range from job loss to social ostracism. Americans live in fear of the moment when a personal enemy dredges up a bad old tweet, or members of the media resurface an impolitic comment in a text message. And the eyes and ears are everywhere. One simple tip from someone on Facebook to a pseudo-journalist activist can result in a worldwide scandal. Your boss cares what you say, so do your friends. Cross the social justice warriors and you will be canceled. It's not a matter of if, only when. The only safety from the mob is to become a part of the mob. Silence used to be a possibility. Now, silence is taken as resistance. Everyone must stand and applaud for Stalin, and he who sits down first is sent to the gulag. So repeat and believe. Perhaps the most galling aspect of our culturally authoritarian moment is the blithe assurance whereby Americans are informed that they are exaggerating. There's no such thing as cancel culture, our woke rulers assure us, while busily hunting down our most embarrassing political faux pas. There's nothing wrong, they say, with calling your boss to try to get you fired. After all, that's the free market just working. Why are you whining about social media censorship or about social ostracism? People have a right to tear you to shreds, to end your career, to malign your character. It's all free speech. In a certain sense, they're not wrong. Your boss does have a right to fire you. Your friends and family do have a right to cut you off. None of that amounts to a violation of the First Amendment. It simply amounts to the end of the republic. Free speech and free exchange of ideas die when the attitude of philosophical tolerance withers. Government authoritarianism isn't the only way to kill American freedom. Cultural authoritarianism works too. It has always worked. Writing in 1831, the greatest observer of America and democracy, Alexis de Tocqueville, summed up the threat of democratic despotism in terms that sounds shockingly, eerily prescient. Under the absolute government of one alone, despotism struck the body crudely so as to reach the soul, and the soul escaping from those blows rose gloriously above it. But in democratic republics, tyranny does not proceed in this way. It leaves the body and goes straight for the soul. The master no longer says to it, "You shall think as I do or you shall die." He says, "You are free not to think as I do. Your life, your goods, everything remains to you. But from this day on, you are a stranger among us. You shall keep your privileges in the city, but they will become useless to you. For if you crave the vote of your fellow citizens, they will not grant it to you. And if you demand only their esteem, they will still pretend to refuse it to you. You shall remain among men, but you shall lose your rights of humanity. When you approach those like you, they shall flee you as being impure. And those who believe in your innocence, even they shall abandon you, for one would flee them in their turn. Go in peace. I leave you your life, but I leave it to you worse than death." This is the America we currently occupy. As Axios reporter Jim VandeHei writes, "Blue America is ascendant in almost every area. It won control of all three branches of government, dominates traditional media, owns, controls, and lives on the dominant social platforms, and has the employee-level power at big tech companies to force corporate decisions. Our nation is rethinking politics, free speech, the definition of truth, and the price of lies. This moment and our decisions will be studied by our kids' grandkids. There is no respite. Your employer requires your fealty to woke principles. Corporations require that you mirror their political priorities. The media treat you as a crude barbarian. There are no distractions. Hollywood mocks your morals and damns you for adherence to them. The sports world requires that you mimic the popular perversities of the moment before being allowed to escape. Social media controls the flow of information you can see while preventing you from speaking your mind. And each day you wonder if today will be the day the mob comes for you." This book is about how our authoritarian moment came to be. It is about the takeover of our most powerful institutions by a core of radicals, and about the miasmatic hatred and dire consequences Americans face for standing up for heretofore uncontroversial principles. But it is also about something more. It is about how to fight back in the right way. Because buried in authoritarianism is always one deep flaw: its insecurity. If authoritarians had broad and deep support, they wouldn't require compulsion. The dirty secret of our woke authoritarians is that they are the minority. You are the majority. It's not that everybody hates you. It's that millions of Americans are afraid to say that they agree with you. We have been silenced, and now is the time for the silence to be broken by one simple, powerful word, a word that has meant freedom since the beginning of time. No. Chapter 1. How to Silence a Majority. On November 8th, 2016, a bombastic reality television star became president of the United States. Donald Trump became president despite months of media hysteria and extraordinary attacks on his campaign and his character. He became president despite the confident predictions of the pollsters and pundits that he had virtually no chance. Most of all, the pollsters and pundits got Trump's level of support wrong because they got Trump's supporters wrong. Trump's supporters, they believed, were a diamond-hard core of bigots, annoying but generally unthreatening, a set of deplorables in Hillary Clinton's phraseology. Then Trump won. This presented the political elitists with two possible choices. They could engage in some well-earned introspection, considering the possibility that they had missed something vital in American political life and re-examining their premises about the nature of the American public, or they could castigate tens of millions of Americans as moral and intellectual deficients. They chose the latter. After some initial media coverage, in which Brooklyn-based Gucci loafer-wearing would-be journalistic Jane Goodall's covered Trump supporters as mysterious, grunting gorillas in the mist, in which graduates of the New York University School of Journalism, fresh-faced and bright-eyed after classes with Lauren Duca on how to bitch about Tucker Carlson in Teen Vogue, traveled to fabled, primitive red state America, a chaotic and brutal place filled with chain restaurants and Walmarts and churches, and characterized by a serious lack of culturally sensitive vegan restaurants and artisanal coffee shops and Planned Parenthood facilities, in which said ACE reporters talked to poor old Billy, a down-on-his-luck former factory worker merely aching for some Democratic subsidy programs, the journalistic establishment came to a conclusion. Trump voters were, as they had originally thought, and as Hillary Clinton had once said, deplorable. They were, as Barack Obama had once characterized them, bitter clingers, desperately clutching to God and guns and racism, wearing their hard hats to decaying factories, then turning them in for white hoods at night to terrorize the neighborhood minorities. Trump voters were poor white Americans in dying Rust Belt towns, hoping to stop demographic shifts by voting Trump. It somehow escaped attention that some 2.8 million New Yorkers voted for Trump, or 4.5 million Californians. There are lots of Republicans who don't sit around in diners wearing trucker hats. This was a convenient narrative. It certainly relieved journalists of the obligation to leave their comfort zones, both literally and figuratively. No need to spend a night in rural Ohio rather than the comforts of the Upper West Side, or to bother discussing uncomfortable issues with the rubes. It also allowed journalists to abandon the practice of journalism more broadly. Now, instead of focusing on Trump's policies, they could simply focus on his tweets, the id-driven manifestations of their original thesis. Every tweet could be read as a confirmation of their hypothesis about red state Americans. Now, instead of examining all sides of various political controversies, they could simply assume the sinfulness of their opponents and demand surrender. Journalism became a search and destroy mission directed not merely at Trump, but at Trump's supporters. This wasn't much of a change, as it turned out. Republicans of all stripes had always been the problem, not just Trump. Before Trump was a glint in the media's eye, the media had targeted a small-town plumber who had the temerity to ask Barack Obama a question about his tax policy. They dug up his tax record, his home address, his plumbing license. Mitt Romney, the most milquetoast human being of the modern era, had been castigated by the media as a racist and a bigot. John McCain, who would later be hailed as an anti-Trump hero, was hit with similar slander. The media itself had shifted on Trump personally over the years. For years, he'd been treated as easy clickbait, a genial figure of comedy and an outsized figure of wealth and pomposity, an icon of garish frivolity and entertaining charlatanry, up until the point he declared himself a Republican candidate for the presidency. Even then, Trump received late-night phone calls from Jeff Zucker and advice from Joe Scarborough. Then, he won the Republican nomination. Overnight, he became the fonthead of evil, because overnight, he became the symbol of his supporters, not the other way around. After all, it wasn't as though the media would have treated Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio as anything but pariahs had either won the nomination. As Trump would later argue, they hated him mostly because they hated his supporters. This created an extraordinary amount of loyalty to Trump among Republicans. Republicans felt that Trump had merely taken bullets otherwise aimed at them. And they weren't totally wrong. The political slings and arrows were aimed at them. Trump just made an easier, more convenient, and more justifiable target. The media wasn't the only institution committed to the narrative that all conservatives, or at least the ones who hadn't flipped and joined the Lincoln Project, earning strange new respect, were vicious racists, know-nothing xenophobes, bigoted idiots. Nearly every major American institution was committed to the same idea. Conservatives felt the left-wing authoritarianism. They understood it on a gut level, and they hated it. They felt the top-down censorship from social media, which deemed their speech hate speech and their worldview harassment. They felt the anti-conventionalism from Hollywood, which painted conservatives as the great threat to a more beautiful, tolerant, and diverse country. And from their bosses, who declared their fealty to tolerant, liberal ideas while not so subtly threatening to fire dissenters. And from their friends and family, who told them in no uncertain terms that they were not welcome at the table. They saw the revolutionary aggression of a radical left directed against fundamental American ideas and patted on the back by all of America's most powerful institutions. Conservatives were to be treated as outsiders. Anyone who voted for Trump was to be banned from polite society, to be treated as a gangrenous limb. Better to lop them off from the body politic than allow their poison to fester. In fact, it wasn't enough merely to silence conservatives who didn't actively oppose Trump. Silence, as the nonsensical woke slogan went, was violence. Conservatives had to be outed. Even those who might not feel themselves sympathetic to Trump had to be outed if they so much as engaged in conversation with Trump voters, or even those open to engaging in conversation with Trump voters. Such discussions, the logic went, would serve to humanize the inhuman, to tolerate the intolerable. Excision of the occasional Trump supporter was utterly insufficient. Exorcism of the very concepts that could lead to the presence of Trump support had to be undertaken. Confessions had to be forced. Purity tests had to be administered. Struggle sessions had to be initiated. Symbols of loyalty would be demanded. Properly self-righteous hashtags on Twitter. Anti-Trump bumper stickers on cars. Semantically overloaded, tautology-laden lawn signs plunked into well-manicured grass. Statements of dissociation would have to be undertaken. Dissociation from newly identified code terms like meritocracy and Western civilization and colorblindness. Dissenters would be lumped in with Trump supporters. The Overton window, the window of acceptable discourse, would be smashed shut, then boarded over. And our cultural leftist authoritarians thought it had worked. In 2018, Democrats won an overwhelming electoral victory, swamping Republicans across the country and seizing control of the House of Representatives, flipping 41 seats blue. Support for Democrats washed through the suburban areas of the United States, flipping 308 state legislative races in favor of Democrats. That was without Trump on the ballot. With Trump on the ballot, the symbol of evil himself, bigotry and racism and vulgarity and brutality made orange flesh. Surely Democrats would usher in a never-ending golden era of dominance and cement Republicans into minority status for a generation. And sure enough, 1 week before the election of 2020, Joe Biden was apparently ahead in the polls by nearly double digits. Democrats had a generic ballot advantage in Congress of nearly 7 points. Triumph was at hand, except it wasn't. It turns out that if the major cultural institutions in a society declare all-out war on a large percentage of the population, those people don't convert. They go underground. And that's precisely what they did. They fibbed to pollsters or didn't pick up the phone at all. They didn't tell their friends and family how they were voting. They didn't post on Facebook or Twitter. They didn't tell their bosses their real thoughts about Joe Biden or Kamala Harris or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Then they entered the polling places and they voted. And they voted against those who had declared them the cultural enemy. Donald Trump may have lost the election, but Republicans across the land didn't. Republicans outperformed the polls across the board. Many pollsters had projected that Trump would lose by double digits nationwide. Instead, Trump personally won more votes than any other Republican in American history, and more votes than any candidate in American history outside of his opponent, Joe Biden. Some pollsters had suggested that Republicans would easily lose the Senate and drop a dozen seats in the House. Instead, Republicans nearly maintained the Senate, losing control only because of Trump's asinine intervention in two winnable Georgia Senate races, gained seats in the House, maintained their stranglehold on state legislatures in a redistricting year, and nearly retained the White House too. The elevation of a geriatric non-entity like Joe Biden was no endorsement of the Democratic agenda. It was far more likely a rejection of Trump's personality, which came as little surprise after years of erratic tweeting, bizarre personal behavior, and extraordinarily savage media coverage. Trump underperformed Republicans in nearly every state with a competitive Senate race. Republicans swept into power in New Hampshire, where Trump lost by nearly 8 points. Trump bled in the suburbs. Had he lost the suburbs by the same margins he did in 2016, he would have been reelected. So Americans may have rejected Donald Trump personally, but the silent majority, a majority the media, the pollsters, and the experts completely missed, broadly rejected the Democratic agenda in truly shocking fashion. Americans didn't vote in defiance of the polls because they were racists. They didn't vote in favor of Trump because they were bigots. They didn't vote for Susan Collins in Maine and Tom Tillis in North Carolina and Steve Daines in Montana because they were benighted rednecks committed to a vanishing demographic majority. Latinos didn't vote in outsized numbers for Trump because they were suddenly white, even though Pulitzer Prize-winning prevaricator and much ballyhooed mountebank Nicole Hannah-Jones of the New York Times declared them so. Black males didn't vote in surprising numbers for Trump because they'd abandoned their race, as Joe Biden himself implied. Suburban white women didn't vote Republican because they had decided they were in love with Donald Trump's casual grossness with women. These Americans voted the way they did because they are Americans and because they demand to be heard. Because they refuse to surrender to the alliance of the authoritarian left and their liberal enablers. Because they never agreed with the media or their bosses or their idiot nephews in college carrying around copies of unread Ta-Nehisi Coates books to get laid. Because they won't be bullied into putting up meaningless symbols on their social media pages or into declaring that all police are racist or into cheering on the idea that America ought to be denigrated. They went quiet. They didn't go away. And then they weren't quiet anymore. That's why the pollsters got it wrong. It wasn't because pollsters are purely incompetent. It's because pollsters can't pry answers out of those who have been intimidated into silence. As Eric Kaufman, professor of politics at the University of London, observed, pollsters didn't actually get it wrong with white non-college educated voters. Those who are likely to feel the least peer pressure from the self-empowered newfangled cultural fascisti. They got it wrong with precisely the people most likely to feel pressured, white college graduates. As Kaufman concludes, if America cannot reform its regime of speech discipline, it has no hope of overcoming its yawning cultural divide. In order to overcome that yawning cultural divide, however, we must first acknowledge the obvious. Our divide is cultural. It is not economic. It is not racial. It is cultural. The culture war. Our philosophical betters, the elitist opinion makers who claim to understand the deeper meaning in our politics, generally present two explanations for division in America, race and class. Both are utterly insufficient. The Marxist theory of class-driven division has long provided a shoddy explanation for real-world phenomena. During World War I, Marxist theorists were firmly convinced that international warfare would certainly result in a revolution by the working class, only to find that workers of the world were actually Brits, Frenchmen, Germans, and Russians. Today, Thomas Piketty explains Trump by appealing to rising income inequality, but can't understand just why Trump voters continue to reject the overt redistributionism of the Democratic Party. By Marxist theory, Trump voters should have become Bernie voters over time. They aren't. The racial theory of American politics is similarly non-explanatory. That theory supposed that Trump's outsized white support in 2016 was evidence of a white majoritarian backlash to an ascendant minority coalition. But that theory was firmly debunked in 2018, when white suburban voters handed a majority to Democrats in Congress, and in 2020, when Trump increased his vote share among minorities, but lost vote share among white voters, and white men particularly. If racial animus were the driving force behind Trumpism, or Republicanism more broadly, that wouldn't have manifested itself in a 55% Cuban vote for Trump in Florida, or in Trump closing the gap in majority Latino Rio Grande Valley districts like Starr and Hidalgo counties from 60 and 40 points in 2016 to 5 and 17 in 2020. Trump didn't overperform estimates among Latino and Black voters because he was a racist. He overperformed because the elitists in our institutions declare things racist even when they aren't. Joe Biden suggested that Trump engaged in full-time dog whistling, despite Trump's repeated denunciations of white supremacy and his unprecedented outreach to minority communities, including a criminal justice reform program largely opposed by many in the grassroots conservative community. But as it turns out, elitist white Americans and woke anti-racism advocates, who largely overpopulate the media, corporate America, social media halls of power, and Hollywood, don't have a read on broader minority viewpoints. When these elitists declare that standing with the police is a dog whistle, voters of all stripes tune out. In fact, that sort of labeling, the attempt to turn all political opposition into evidence of personal malevolence, the mainstreaming of anti-conventionalism combined with top-down censorship and incentivization of revolutionary aggression, is the reason for the backlash against down-ballot Democrats. Our culture wars aren't about anything so mundane as marriage, policing, or even abortion. Our culture wars are about a simple question. Can we agree that freedom of speech is more important than freedom from offense? Can we hire, work with, and break bread with people who may differ on the nature of the good life, but agree on the individual freedoms that come along with being an American? If the answer is no, you're probably a leftist. If the answer is yes, you're part of the silent majority. And perhaps you're only silent because you don't know that you're in the majority. Why don't you know that? Because for three generations, there's been an ongoing successful attempt to wrest institutional control from the apolitical and to weaponize those institutions on behalf of the authoritarian left. Most Americans tend to think individually, both philosophically and strategically. They spend their time attempting to convince friends and family of their viewpoints rather than infiltrating institutions and using the power of those institutions for mass marketing. Leftists have no such qualms. Most Americans, trusting in the free market and free speech, insist that people be left free to make choices they don't like and oppose the exercise of institutional power. Leftists militarize powerful forces in a variety of fields to achieve their political ends. The authoritarian left has successfully pursued a three-step strategy to effectuate their takeover of the major institutions in our society. The first step, winning the emotional argument. The second step, renormalizing the institutions. The third step, locking all the doors. Convincing Americans to shut up. The left has spent decades gradually suppressing most Americans and encouraging conservatives to suppress themselves. The process began with an appeal to politeness. That appeal became a demand for silence. Then the demand for silence became an order to comply, repeat, and believe. This was a heavy lift, and it didn't happen overnight. The left began with a simple recognition that both conservative and liberal philosophies have soft underbellies. For conservatives, the soft underbelly is a militant insistence on cordiality. Conservatives were, until Donald Trump, deeply concerned with personal values in their politicians, but they were insistent on them in daily life. One of those virtues was peacefulness, affability, treating thy neighbor as thyself. As philosopher Russell Kirk suggested, conservatives believe in peace and stability, in human imperfectibility, and in community. If we believe in peace and stability, that requires tolerance. If we believe human beings are imperfectible, we shouldn't be too quick to judge. If we believe in the value of community, we must be willing to forgive small slights. These are nuanced ideas, but all too often, conservatives boil them down to being proper. And by being proper, conservatives all too often mean being inoffensive. But being inoffensive is a bastardization of the call to decency. Conservatism doesn't merely believe in anodyne cordiality, a cordiality that looks the other way at cruelty or requires silence in the face of sin. Conservatism promotes certain values that come into conflict with leftist values. Conservatism relies on moral judgment too. Conservatism believes that friendship relies on willingness to steer those we love away from sin. As the Bible states, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your fellow, but you shall not bear sin on his account. Nonetheless, leftism identified in conservatives a fundamental willingness to go along to get along, to see cordiality as virtue itself. And it wasn't difficult for leftists to transmute some conservatives' desire to be cordial into a political principle. Anything considered offensive ought to be barred. This principle, we can call it the cordiality principle, manifested in ways directly contrary to the conservative ability to speak freely. Conservatism believes in standards of right and wrong, of good and bad. Distinguishing between good and bad requires the exercise of judgment. The left suggested that judgment was itself wrong, uncivilized, vulgar. Judgment was, of course, judgmental. And this was bad. To be judgmental was to offend someone, and thus to violate the cordiality principle. Equality and inclusion and diversity and multiculturalism became the bywords of the day. As conservative philosopher Roger Scruton writes, in place of the old beliefs of a civilization based on godliness, judgment, and historical loyalty, young people are given the new beliefs of a society based on equality and inclusion and are told that the judgment of other lifestyles is a crime. The non-judgmental attitude toward other cultures goes hand in hand with a fierce denunciation of the culture that might have been one's own. This cordiality principle gained serious traction in arenas ranging from arguments over religion to pornography to abortion to same-sex marriage. Many conservatives became uncomfortable standing up for their own principles in polite company or in moral terms. Better not to be perceived as not very nice. The soft underbelly of liberalism to the cordiality principle was obvious. For liberals, compassion isn't merely a principle. It's an ersatz religion. Where conservatives define virtue in accordance with religious precepts or natural law, liberals define virtue as empathy. Liberals see themselves as compassionate at root. They see themselves through the lens of kindness. And it simply isn't nice to quarrel with others, no matter how demanding. Niceness lies at the core of everything. Better to bite one's tongue than to start a fight, which might be seen as intolerant. The cordiality principle was just the beginning. The second step came when leftists began to contend that judgmentalism wasn't merely a violation of the cordiality principle, it was an actual harm. The argument shifted from just be nice to silence is required. Now, traditionally, offense has not been considered a serious harm. J.S. Mill famously posited the so-called harm principle, the notion that activity that actually harms someone ought to be condemned or even legally barred. But Mill himself rejected the conflation of harm and offense. Just because someone found something offensive, Mill argued, didn't mean that it ought to be regulated or socially banned. The distinction between harm and offense, however, can be murky. Philosopher Joel Feinberg points out that few of us believe that people should publicly have sex with one another. That's a crime against our sense of cordiality. Offensiveness, he says, can in fact be a harm. To that end, Feinberg posited a balancing test. On the one hand, society would balance the seriousness of an offense. On the other hand, society would balance reasonableness of the offending conduct. If offensive conduct did not seriously offend anyone, for example, and was personally important to the offender, the conduct would be allowed. If, however, the offense is profound, the balance could shift, and shift precipitously. The authoritarian left has artificially shifted Feinberg's balance. Every offense to particularly vulnerable groups, meaning groups defined as vulnerable by the left in a kaleidoscopically changing hierarchy of victimhood, represents the possibility of profound offense. Those who engage in such offense must be silenced. Thus, the left has posited that even minor offense amounts to profound damage, hence the language of microaggressions, which posit by their very nature that verbiage is an act of violence. Microaggressions range from the utterly anodyne, where are you from, is apparently a brutal act since it presupposes that the subject of the question is of foreign extraction, to the extraordinarily counterproductive. References to meritocracy are deeply wounding since they presuppose that free systems reward hard work, thus condemning the unsuccessful by implication. Microaggressions require no intent. Intent is not an element of the crime, since we may not be aware, thanks to our own implicit bias, of our own bigotry. They do not even require actual evidence of harm. subjective perception of offense is quite enough. The culture of microaggression is about magnifying claims of harm in order to gain leverage. That leverage can grow to astonishing proportions. Woke staffers got a reporter for the New York Times fired for using the N-word to explain why and when using the N-word was wrong. Times executive editor Dean Baquette even repeated the authoritarian left's favorite mantra, "We do not tolerate racist language, regardless of intent." Regardless of intent. If you can be racist without intent, silence becomes the only protection for most Americans. After all, as Berkeley leftists chanted when I spoke there in 2017, speech is violent. But now the left has gone even further. Now, silence is violent. This idiotic, self-contradictory slogan has been picked up by a myriad of politicians and thought leaders. The idea is that if you remain silent in the face of an evil defined by the left naturally, then you are complicit in that evil. It's no longer enough to oppose racism, for example. You must carry around a copy of Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility, announce your white privilege for the world to hear, and prepare for your inevitable atonement. If you don't, you will be deemed an enemy. Now, don't mistake the slogan "silence is violence" as a call for open speech. Far from it. Silence is violence means that you must speak, but only after doing the work. Learning why your point of view is utterly irrelevant, ceding all ground to woke leftists, and becoming a crusader on behalf of their point of view. If you refuse, you will be targeted. Abject apologies will be demanded. The only way to escape the social media brute squads is to become a member, baying in unison. The renormalization of American institutions. All of this might remain a fringe phenomenon relegated to the wilds of Twitter and college campuses, but for a simple fact. The culture of authoritarian leftism has now hijacked nearly all of Americans' major institutions and cultural touchstones. Universities, once bastions of free thought, are now philosophical one-party systems dedicated to the promulgation of authoritarian leftism. Corporations, petrified of legal liability, or at least hoping